Welcome back to the program. We all seem to agree that our political system, in fact, our democracy itself, is broken. What does this mean, though, and how did this happen? What's at its core? What can we do about it? And where can we find its roots? Well, in the words of Deep Throat, follow the money. This is the lesson that Lawrence Lessig tries to teach us in his new book, Republic Lost. Lawrence Lessig is the Roy L. Furman Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. He's director of the Edmund Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard University. He was formerly a professor of law at Stanford Law School, where he founded the school's Center for Internet and Society. Lessig holds degrees from the University of Pennsylvania, Cambridge, and Yale. He is perhaps the leading interpreter in the world today about the value and the importance of the Internet, and it is my pleasure and honor to welcome Lawrence Lessig back to this program to talk about his new work, Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Lawrence Lessig, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
Great to have you here. You have worked in the area of culture, technology, the Internet. What was it that sparked your focus on politics right now?
Well, it was a certain frustration. I found that after a decade of working on areas of culture and the Internet and getting people to recognize the importance of updating the way we regulate that people, businesses, parents, educators, teachers, they all got the need for the change, and they thought it was kind of obvious, and it was increasingly common wisdom. But among policymakers, there was no progress at all. And it led me to one of those moments where I recognized I wasn't quite as smart as I thought I was, because, you know, there was an obvious reason why the policymakers weren't seeing it. It was because they didn't even hear it, because the other side of the debate about extremism in the protection of intellectual property doesn't exist on Capitol Hill, because they don't afford the lawyers on Capitol Hill. So it was a recognition that we weren't going to make progress in these more fundamental areas unless we could make some progress in this really fundamental problem of corruption of our system.
And yet the broader irony in this that struck me as I was reading Republic Lost is that the more freedom we have, the more Internet freedom, the more we move from what you talk about in terms of a read-only culture to a read-write culture, the more of all of that we have, the more corrupt our political system has become.
That's right, although I wouldn't say one causes the other. Indeed, I think that our only hope for dealing with the corruption is the increasing, not just read-write culture, but read-write politics. I mean, it is striking that if you think of the 20th century, we learned in the 20th century both how to be passive consumers of culture, no longer creating our own stuff, but instead just listening to the professionals. And we became passive consumers of politics. Just sit on the couch and listen to the television ads and then go out and vote, but don't imagine you should be out there making your own signs or organizing your own movements. But, you know, the 20th century has brought us both read-write politics and read-write culture. So kids increasingly don't just make mixtapes the way we did growing up. They make remixes of the music they want to listen to. And the coolest, most powerful signs on the Occupy Wall Street protests are not the professionally produced or even amateur produced using high quality graphics software signs. It's the handmade signs. It's the people who are just expressing themselves directly and organizing in this completely grassroots take back control way. So there's a dynamic that's similar between the two, and I think it's actually the potential for doing something important.
Is it any surprise, should it surprise us at all, that when we look at the problems we're facing today, and they may be more institutional and more intractable, but that when you connect the dots, they lead back to money? This is a historic problem. It's just gotten so much worse in our current environment.
It's gotten worse and different. You know, 100 years ago, America had a critical election, the 1912 election, where 70% of Americans voted for a candidate who called himself progressive. There were two progressive presidential candidates. They were very different on a million dimensions, but the one place they were similar was their view that the government had become corrupted and it was time to end that corruption. But the corruption of the Gilded Age was a kind of crass quid pro quo bribery corruption that defines the way people typically think about corruption. The corruption that we have now is not that corruption. I think, you know, in that sense, we have the cleanest Congress we've had in the history of Congress. Congress is not filled with criminals who are accepting or soliciting bribes. But Congress has to live in a system where, in a much more transparent, much more in plain sight, and certainly legal way, they have to achieve effectively the same kind of influence peddling if they're going to find the ways to fund their campaigns. And that's the counterintuitive bit about this. We, in some sense, have less traditional corruption. But the kind of corruption we have now, I think, is profoundly more damaging to the republic.
And what that corruption does, as you talk about it, is that it inherently ignores the losers and enhances the winners in a more profound and pronounced way than it ever has.
Yeah, that's right. It's a little harsh, I think, to say it ignores the losers. It just doesn't ignore the people. It just ignores those people who don't contribute directly and significantly into the political campaign. So if you recognize that candidates pay most attention to those who max out to their campaign, you know, you can give right now up to $2,500 to a campaign, and you ask in 2010 what percentage of Americans maxed out in congressional campaign contributions, the answer is 0.05%. So, you know, when the Occupy Wall Street people have their dramatic poster, "We are the 99%," they actually should be saying, "We are the 99.95% who doesn't get listened to because we don't play the game by giving the maximum contributions in the system." So we have a system that's distorted because, in completely obvious and understandable ways, candidates have to spend their time appealing to the 0.05% and therefore are responsive to them and not responsive to the rest of us.
It is arguably corrupt also that there is this constant use of tax and revenue policy, as you talk about it, to essentially raise campaign funds.
Yeah. I mean, this, you can see this in a lot of ways. One of the most dramatic is, if you think, Huffington posted this great piece about what was the most important issue, got the most time in Congress in the first 4 months of this year. You know, we're in the middle of two wars. We have a huge deficit problem. We have still a massive unemployment problem. Issues about health care, issues about global warming are unresolved. So what was the number one issue they spend their time focused on? The bank swipe fee controversy, whether debit cards will get more money to the banks because the fee has been allowed to be raised, or whether retailers will have to pay less for each debit card swipe because the fees have been lowered. Now, you think, why would Congress waste its time on that issue when we've got so many other more important issues? And the answer is, if you can appear a little bit fickle as a member of Congress about which side you care about in this fight between the banks and the retailers, you'll find showering down upon you endless amounts of campaign cash from either side that's trying to woo you over. So you begin to think it's not just that the substance of issues might be affected. It's also the very thing that Congress focuses on. It's being driven by this pursuit of money. So why don't we deal with unemployment? Turns out unemployment doesn't pay very much to congressmen in their political campaigns, and therefore doesn't get the attention that it deserves in any other measure of what's important in America.
And this is why, in so many respects, that this relentless focus on money has really made the whole system broken in so many ways, because it was a system designed, as you talk about, to be dependent on the people, not the funders.
That's right. Our framers had a very clear conception of the type of dependency they wanted, and they used that word. That was a very important word at the time, both criticizing dependencies, as Jane Austen in her novels would describe, but also creating the right kind of dependency. And the dependency which they wanted for our republic was a dependency upon the people alone. And the problem is, we've allowed Congress to evolve a different and conflicting dependency, a dependency upon the funders. And as that second dependency, you know, like as with an alcoholic who becomes increasingly dependent upon this conflicting dependency on alcohol, as that grows, more and more of their life is constantly spent looking to the side to satisfy their need, rather than looking ahead to what they were intended to be pursuing. Now, in that sense, I think it's obvious why this is a corruption. It's not a corruption in the sense of a bunch of criminal congressmen running around doing illegal acts,
right,
but it is a corruption of the intended dependence that our framers had, and that's the sense in which this system has become corrupt and needs to be reformed.
And how has it impacted policy outcomes as you see it? I mean, clearly one of the arguments that are made by the Occupy movement people, and one of the arguments we hear, is that it's resulted in policy outcomes that wind up favoring the rich.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the best example, the most dramatic example, is Wall Street. You know, so up into the period before 2008, Wall Street succeeded in facilitating a change in regulation that essentially led to, by 2008, 90% of the assets traded on Wall Street being traded in the shadow invisible market. These are derivatives that were deregulated and so not subject to any of the public exchange requirements. And it was that shadow market that created the enormous instability, which eventually nobody could calculate, and therefore we made all sorts of mistakes that brought the economy down. Now, after that happened, every independent analyst looking at this problem, from the left and the right, recognized that this misregulation, this system of deregulation, was in part responsible for what had happened. So you might say it's nothing surprising that Wall Street was able to essentially fund the deregulation of the industry before 2008 because the zeitgeist was deregulation. Everybody thought deregulation was the answer to every one of our ills. But after 2008, after everybody had said the deregulation was in part the problem, after the dean of deregulation, Alan Greenspan, testified to Congress that he had been mistaken about his views about the role of deregulation in this field, what's astonishing is Wall Street even then has the power to blackmail both Democrats and Republicans to avoid any fundamental change in the underlying architecture of our financial system. So if we were too big to fail in 2006, we are only too big and fail in a bigger way in 2012. And that is the terrifying and astonishing fact about the power of this, the largest contributor to Democratic and Republican campaigns, the industry of financial services and insurance. That is the frightening thing about where, in fact, we've come with that one industry alone.
And as you look at this and sort of connect the proverbial dots, you start to see, as you talk about, the impact that it's had on democracy itself, that we've really moved away from the kind of democracy, the kind of republic that the founders intended.
Yeah, I mean, I think one, you can measure this in a lot of dimensions. One important dimension is this loss of trust or confidence in the institution. So as we believe money buys results in Congress, that leads us to believe that there's no reason for us to have confidence in that institution. So Gallup last year calculated that 11% of Americans have confidence in Congress. Things have gotten better. This year it's now 12% of Americans who have confidence in Congress. And you have to say, well, you know, when does an institution have to declare political bankruptcy? What number is too low? Certainly when we declared war against Britain in 1776, there were more people who believed in the British crown than who believe in our Congress today. So, like, what is the number when the institution's got to just put up the white flag and say, we have to give up? And I think that as you see the confidence drop, you see participation in the system drop. So rather than, as many scholars, Mo Fiorini most prominently, have demonstrated, most Americans are pretty middle of the road. They're most of us are actually pretty moderate in our views about politics. But the moderate middle stays home and disengages from this system because of these views about its corruption and lack of confidence in the system. And it leaves the field to the extremists of the left and the right. And so we get more and more polarized as a function of people being less and less engaged, and it makes the system increasingly incapable of dealing with the most fundamental issues. Look, other countries around the world address issues that we can't begin to address. Whether you like their result or not, they can address global warming, they can address health care, they can address issues about unemployment, because they don't have a system that is so deeply tied to interests that can block any reform from either direction of the left or the right.
How much is a sense of equality important in this discussion?
Well, I think we need to recognize the framers were egalitarians absolutely in one field at least, and that is the idea of citizenship power, right? So we imagined a democracy where citizens would exercise their power in the way elections allowed them to exercise power. And in the way that we've devolved elections, it's constitutionally required that your vote weighs as much as my vote. So if districts are drawn so that your vote is more powerful than my vote, then the Supreme Court says you've got to redraw those districts. So equality in voting power is a central component to our republic. Yet what's bizarre is we've allowed that equality to stand next to a fundamental inequality, which drives politicians to pay less and less attention to the equal vote of all of us and more attention to the unequal power that the funders would have inside the system as they strive to raise the money they need to get back to Congress. So I don't think that our Constitution requires egalitarianism in the economic sphere, and I don't think it requires egalitarianism in the sense that everybody's idea has to be equally as powerful. And I don't think that it has anything to say if unions are able to turn out 100,000 people at the polls and the NRA is allowed to turn out 200,000 people at the polls, because that's the way power is supposed to be exercised inside the system. But I do think that our system does not allow, at least if we were honest about its principles, that equality to be corrupted by this massive inequality in the way we spend money in our political systems that drives candidates away from focusing on voters and increasingly on funders.
And then we have things like Citizen United, which ups the ante even more.
Right, because now in addition to shape-shifting to keep your funders happy, you have to shape-shift to keep the independent expenditure cramp happy. And, it's taken a comedian to demonstrate to America exactly how unindependent these independent expenditure committees are. But it's, everybody in America recognizes the dance that candidates go through in order to induce the right kind of independent expenditure spending in campaigns. So we have now a dual kind of distortion. Whereas before the explosion after Citizens United, I think the thing we're properly worried about is the single distortion to make your funders happy.
As we look at the potential power of the Internet in democracy, is there somewhere in there some kind of solution to this, or at least some kind of a foothold?
Yes, although it's not going to be the kind of sit at home and tweet or click on a mail link and send to 10,000 friends type of influence. I think what the Internet helps us do is to organize effectively this kind of grassroots, bottom-up-like movement and help inspire it and get people to see why it's important and excited. But it's also going to take people actually doing something, like going out and sitting in or protesting or voting or showing up at a congressional meeting and demanding a congressman address the question of the corruption of Congress, and it's going to take real action by us. So it's not that the Internet allows us to be virtual in politics. It's just the Internet allows a kind of virtual organization to take over, displacing the kind of top-down, centralized political organization that has dominated politics since 1960.
Of course, the counterforce to that is the degree to which those that are in power at the moment, even within the realm of business or technology, want to protect the present, want to make sure that whatever might happen in the future might not happen because it doesn't serve their interests.
Yeah, and I think that's the biggest challenge here. Jim Cooper, a Democrat from Tennessee, who's been in Congress for as long as all but about 20 members of Congress, said to me the biggest change that he's noticed on Capitol Hill is that Capitol Hill has become a farm league for K Street, for the lobbyist street. And what that means is that members have this business model in their head, a significant number of them, and the business model is my life after Congress, my life as a lobbyist. Well, any change that would address the problem of the distortion caused by funders versus the people would significantly lower the value of being a lobbyist. So it would be a way for the member of Congress to vote for a plan that basically cuts his retirement package by down two-thirds or at least a half, right? So none of them are going to be eager to do this. And the hardest part about this reform is to recognize that it might actually take a citizens' movement outside of Washington, outside of the corruption of inside the Beltway of Washington. And I don't think we actually have a good model for how that's done. But it's going to require we citizen politicians who take over the process for a period to exercise this kind of change, because I don't think they're going to do it on their own.
It happens internally, too. I mean, even outside of Congress, even the work that lobbyists on K Street do, they are for different businesses, and I know you've talked about it a lot with respect to broadband, protecting the status quo and in some ways preventing the future from happening, arguably.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, this is the dynamic of Washington. The lobbyists are able to sell their very high-priced services to the incumbents, the people who are successful right now, whether that's in telecom or in culture industry or in pharmaceuticals, or you pick it. And those incumbents are able to leverage their power, their wealth, to get the government to protect them. And so this is the sense in which the problem we've got right now is a problem which both conservatives and liberals have long talked about. So I did a teach-in at K Street, Occupy K Street, and I said, look, whether, you know, you may or may not believe in capitalism, and I believe in capitalism. I'm though a liberal, I believe in free markets. But, you know, a lot of people are skeptical about capitalism. Okay. But nobody believes in crony capitalism. And crony capitalism is this system where the most powerful, the most wealthy are able to leverage their power to protect themselves against the competitive market. And so I think that we have a chance in focusing on this kind of corruption to draw a line that might pull together left and right to address a really fundamental corruption that is our system.
Is the problem so much bigger today because of the rate at which change can happen or should happen that, in fact, protecting the status quo has an even more profound effect today because it's holding back more potential change?
Certainly. Global warming is the best example of that. You know, the status quo, oil industries, the coal industries, have been enormously successful in blocking and avoiding any fundamental policies that might address the problem of global warming in the United States. Astonishingly, right? In the Gore election, and then in the, even George Bush signaled he believed in the global warming issue. John McCain signaled he believed in global warming in the election with Obama. So this was, you know, not a contested issue in those presidential elections, and now it's deeply contested, and it's deeply contested in large part because of the extraordinary amount of money that's been spent to make it contested. Well, you know, we've done nothing about it, and we've done nothing about it in a context where everybody agrees that there's an, you know, who knows something about it, agrees there's an urgency to doing something. So, you know, one reaction to the failure of government might be to say, let's just ignore it and go back home and deal with the problems we have at home. But we're in a moment where we just can't ignore these problems. These problems are too big. They are too profound for not just the nation, but the globe. And so the speed with which we cause harm by not avoiding these problems is one of the reasons it's so urgent to find a way to address and solve these problems.
As we look around the globe and we look at countries that are running these problems through systems that are less corrupt in the way we've been talking about, less corrupt than ours, less affected by money, what are we seeing and what's the comparison?
Well, I don't think that there's any political utopia. You know, I think interestingly, you know, we've solved the problem of bribery, corruption, and many other nations haven't. But Northern European nations, I spoke at the Swedish parliament and had dinner with a bunch of parliamentarians afterwards. And, you know, these members of parliament, one of them said to me, I have literally never in my whole life in parliament, and he'd been in parliament for about 15 years, ever once asked anybody for money. And I said, well, what do you think your job is? And he said, well, my job is just to be a kind of policy wonk that understands what my constituents want and tries to make it work inside of our democracy. And these are systems where, because there's public funding of public elections and because there's significant amount of support for access to television to make party views known to the public, you have democracy where there isn't the intense and insane obsession by special interests to try to leverage government to their own side. And I think that, you know, we've got a very unique constitution and a unique First Amendment that's going to cause some difficulties in bringing about the kind of changes that I think we need. But we can, without changing the constitution, tomorrow change the way in which we fund elections in a way that would profoundly affect the incentives of members of Congress to behave in their very special interest-focused way and allow them, once again, to be independent enough to focus on what we the people might want.
Are there a set of rights or entitlements for those that are successful and that are wealthy that we need to be balancing in all of this?
Well, the Constitution gives us those. You know, we can't just go and take people's property. If you want to take somebody's property, you got to pay them for it. It's got to be for public purpose. There are limits on the ways in which we regulate. There's due process limits that make sure that when you regulate with the right kind of analysis and study. So we have a system to make it so that once one's successful in the marketplace, that success is respected. And, you know, I don't think anybody would think that, you know, a nation like the United States, which has effectively rejected inheritance taxes, is a nation that is seeking to radically redistribute and socialize the nation. So I don't think wealth has to worry about that. I think what the kind of wealth that needs to worry is the wealth that gets its power and its wealth through corrupting of the system. So that's why, you know, I sometimes in these talks say, could you have imagined an Occupy Silicon Valley movement? Right, you know, people lining up outside of Apple saying, yeah, let's get Apple. And the answer is no, because I don't think Americans hate the idea of success and wealth being rewarded to success when they see the relationship between the genius and the wealth. You know, so Apple or Google or Microsoft, you know, you pick it, Adobe. These are companies that have been enormously successful because they did great stuff for us. As opposed to Wall Street, where people look at the extraordinary games that Wall Street played because they had bought a regulatory system that allowed them to play those games, and they gambled with the dumbest form of socialism we ever have invented, where we socialize the risk and privatize the benefit. We pay the downside, they get the upside. They look at this and they say, this is just a Ponzi scheme, and there's no reason I should respect the enormous wealth that has been produced there. It's not to say that financial innovation isn't valuable. Of course it is. But financial gambling on a national scale is not valuable, and you shouldn't have been allowed to do it, and you were only allowed to do it because you corrupted the political system to buy the rules that allowed you to do it. And that's what grounds the anger and frustration against Wall Street. It's not we hate rich people. We hate corrupt people, and Wall Street is the pointer in our system for the most corrupt influence inside of our political system.
And is it your sense that this Occupy movement now might be sort of the forefront of people getting angry about this?
I think if they frame their message carefully, as they mature as a movement and they try to ask, what is the thing we really are upset about? And can we articulate something we're upset about that more than just left-wingers can be upset about? So, you know, if you want to get all upset about capitalism and you want to get rid of capitalism, okay, you'll get 20%, if you're lucky, of America to get rally behind you. But if you started talking about crony capitalism, you could have 80% of America rallying behind you, as nobody defends crony capitalism. So I think as they mature, if they can focus their message in a way that drives to the right type of reform, a reform that could unite the nation, then it could be that movement, but we'll see. It's going to take a lot of change for that to happen.
Lawrence Lessig, his book is Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Lawrence, it is always a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thanks. Great to be back.